Rabbi Richard Address's keynote address at the American Conference of Cantors 2015 convention in Florida.
The title of your convention of Riding the Waves into the Future is very, very profound, because really, ladies and gentlemen, what I want to talk to you this morning about is this other wave that's taking place right now in our country and specifically in our community. And that is really this whole age wave. And here's what I'm going to try and do with you. And we're going to follow up in the two workshops, one on rituals, which is going to talk about a lot of different types of life stage events and ritual creations, from removing a wedding ring after a year of mourning to a redefinition of adultery in light of Alzheimer's. That's just a tease. And tomorrow's workshop, I'm going to deal with a lot of the life stages that all of us are involved with in the pastoral counseling role, and the, perhaps the necessity of creating new vocabulary for some of these life stages. But I want to really outline for you this morning some things to think about, and putting on my old regional director hat and program department, because my career with the union started in Philly, where I'm from. I'm a Philadelphian. And by the way, if you need help in really good places to go next year when you come to Philadelphia, I'll be more than happy to help you get away from the touristy places and where to get a really good, you should pardon the expression, I don't want to offend you, cheesesteak. You do not want to go to Pat's or Gino's, it's for tourists. And for those of you who don't know Philly, it's one of the great restaurant towns in of America right now, so it's really a lot of good places. Okay. And I may be able to score you some Phillies tickets, because they're really easy to get now. I have trouble giving away my Sunday season tickets. Nobody wants them anymore. You know, I have to take a shower, somebody saying, I know. Okay. Here's what we want to do. I want to outline for you some of the issues that are now affecting our community, in specific and in generalities. And outline a particular series of ideas theologically that I hope you consider to think about. You can follow a lot of this on our website, jewishsacredaging.com, which is the only website in the Jewish community that deals with baby boomers and congregational approaches to aging. And it's also on Facebook, the Facebook page. These are some interesting statistics. And given the demography of what I'm seeing in the convention and in this room right now, I'm going to bet you those tickets that a lot of you know exactly what I'm going to be talking about, because a lot of you are living it, have lived it, and if you haven't, trust me, you will. Right now, on June 30th of 2015, about 25% of our American Jewish community is over the age of 65. The fastest, and these are based upon National Jewish Population Studies, the North American Jewish Data Bank, these are all on public record, so if you don't believe me, you can look them up. The fastest growing sub-cohort of this are people over the age of 85. This is a new aging Jewish community. They're not sitting in the patio of Shady Acres waiting to die. You know these people. Some of them are here. These are a group of people who are active. They're right now on their way down about 2 or 3 miles from here to go on the cruise. They're climbing Machu Picchu. They're flooding places like Florida Atlantic University up the road about an hour on continuing education and really seeking that. We are in the United States Jewish community still aging faster than the normative American community. And one of the other issues, and Edie and I got in trouble during the department days when we actually put forth these statistics, all of which are validated by population studies, we're aging quicker than the American community, and we're below replacement level, especially in the non-Orthodox community. In the United States of America, and these are government statistics, and you know the government does not lie. Approximately 10,000 people per day right now turn 65. And this will continue for about the next two decades. Two-thirds of all people who have been alive that are 65 years and of age and over are currently alive. Two-thirds of the people who ever been 65 years of age and over are currently alive. And the aging of our generation, the baby boomer generation, continues rapidly as those 10,000 shows. Every single baby boomer as of this year, 2015, who is now alive is at least 50 years of age. Start doing the math on Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. And the United States Census Bureau is telling us that by the year 2050, which believe it or not is not that far away, people over the age of 60 in the United States will outnumber children for the first time in our history. And there's a global age wave. If you look at some of the statistics and some of them, there's articles about this almost every single day. We're actually behind certain countries in Western Europe and in Asia, Japan and China specifically. So we have to begin to ask how our congregations and our institutional Jewish world is beginning to respond. There's another trend. I had this woman actually in a half an hour, they're going to replay the radio show. I have a radio show on these subjects in Philly every week. And the first guest for this morning is a woman who specializes in something called gray divorce. The New York Times carried a big article about this about 2 years ago. This is another phenomenon of this aging thing that a lot of us who are involved in counseling, I guarantee you, see in your offices. In 1990, 8% of the divorces in the United States were people over the age of 50. Within the last decade, that number's jumped to 25%. And that yields an increasing amount of later stage remarriages. We're going to talk about this in one of the workshops, which really, for those of you who do marriages, you do premarital counseling, it begins to raise the issue. This is a serious issue that the movement hasn't looked at yet. Do we need to begin to reevaluate the type of premarital counseling we do when somebody walks into our office who are 58 and 60, carrying with them a previous marriage, adult children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It's different when you talk to a kid who's 28 and 30. Do we need to reevaluate that? We'll talk a little bit about that at the workshop tomorrow. The rise in new cohabitation forms and later life stages. We're going to discuss this in the ritual workshop because we're all going to talk about a ritual that actually celebrates cohabitation without marriage. The AARP study, one of their recent studies, indicated the impact of changing gender roles. We all know that women make up the majority of caregivers in this country. But so far as this gray divorcing, this is something that it's also interesting. In the last couple of years, women over the age of 50 have initiated 50% of these so-called gray divorces. And there's a couple of other areas that I want to suggest to you that are rarely discussed. One, mental health. You got to go back to your congregations. I know in homiletics we're taught we can't tell you what you must do. But look, all of you are on the front lines of most of you are on the front lines of congregational life or agency life or institutional life. You know what's coming through our congregations, what's sitting in your offices, what you're dealing with on a daily basis. The longevity revolution has produced a concomitant rise of real significant mental health concerns. There's a significant rise in older adult isolation, yielding to depression, yielding to suicidal thoughts and sometimes suicide. And as the Devar Torah, the Azkara mentioned, this is something that really needs to be explored more. This is happening right now. The expected rise in the number of Alzheimer's and dementia patients for which the country is not even prepared, and certainly our community. The Alzheimer's Association is telling us that right now, there are approximately 5 million people dealing with Alzheimer's in the United States of America. Given the age wave and the boom in this in the next couple of decades, that number is supposed to jump from 5 to 15 million. Who's going to take care of us? Who's going to pay for it? How are the families in our congregations going to deal? How are your congregations going to be dealing with this? Part of our work in the department and the region was the caring community. And when I go down and consult with congregations now in caring communities, this is one of the first things we begin to talk about, support programs, Bikur Cholim programs, Because this is a major, major concern. This is right around the corner. The second thing that is really talked about is this whole, and Rabbi Mentor is here doing, and she's pioneering this, is the whole issue of disabilities. I'm not necessarily talking about younger people with disabilities and in your religious school, but an area that is rarely discussed, and that is who's going to take care of adult children who are dealing with significant disabilities when this parental generation passes away. What's going to take care, who's going to take care of them? Where do these people go? There aren't enough facilities and trained people to take care of them. This is all part of this age revolution. This also leads, ladies and gentlemen, to another issue, which I'm going to suggest to you, for those of you who are involved in social justice issues, I really do believe this will be one of the major social justice concerns of the next couple of decades, and that is what I call the economics of aging. Some of us in this room have had to deal with this already. And you know, and from those of you who counsel families in your congregations, you know that this can just rivet a family and take over their existence. Larry Kotlikoff, who's a professor of economics at Boston University, has written two major books, one called The Coming Generational Storm and one called The Clash of Generations. He pioneered this idea of a ratio of workers paying into entitlement programs. Kotlikoff maintains in his books that this ratio post-World War II is seven workers paying for every one of us who wants to do nothing but go to Phillies games, okay? Currently, that ratio, because of the change in the economics and demographics, is down to approximately 2.5 or 3 to 1. There's less people working full-time paying into those programs. When you have this explosion of baby boomers and aging right now, you can figure out whether the scales are tipping. And interestingly enough, very few people want to tackle this in a substantive way. There's a caregiving gap. There was a session at the American Society of Aging Convention in March that talked about this caregiver gap within families. Some of us see this in our congregations. The shrinking number of family caregivers who are available to take care of people and the concomitant shortage of trained geriatricians and qualified care workers to take care of us. This is an extremely interesting and powerful thing given the economics. The last statistic I saw last week in an article on the business section of the Philadelphia Inquirer had that the median cost of a nursing home room in the year 2014 was approximately $240 a day. That's just for a basic nursing, semi-private. You put somebody in a nursing home, it's about $240. Now, if you go to an assisted living facility, as we had to do with my mom, the basic national median was approximately $3,000 a month, and that's for basic a month. If you go to a private nursing, you can begin to do the math. Not everybody has insurance to cover that. So the economics of aging is not theoretical. Some of us in this room right now have had to deal with that and write those checks and figure out who to hire to bring in to take care of somebody. In a brilliant book called The Age of Dignity, this woman by the name of A. Zhen Pu, P-O-O is her last name, brilliant book, was published, I think, in February, called The Age of Dignity, talks about this caregiving crisis. And she maintains that there are not enough trained caregivers and not enough trained geriatricians to care for us boomers as we age out. She writes that by 2018, that's 2.5 years from now, it's not that far away. It's 2.5 years from now. Demand for home health care workers will increase by more than 90%, unquote. And we ask the question, who's going to pay for that? And by the way, how that's going to impact congregational life, and it will. The caregiving challenges, some of you know this really firsthand. You know that the majority of caregivers are women. Who are the last statistic when AARP tried to do an analysis of this is a woman in her late 40s who is working, who's caring for an elderly parent, juggling themselves, their family, their spouse, their job, and their own self. And this whole intergenerational issue In the press, they talk about the sandwich generation. In the work that we do in sacred aging and the program, we never use that term. We use the term club sandwich generation. For those of you who know diners in Jersey, the haute cuisine in Jersey, diners, because caregiving has become an multi-generational issue. And for those of us who've had to do this, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And here are some of the spiritual questions concerned with this, because this is where we really will come into play. If you haven't read this book called Being Mortal by Atal Gawande, go home and read it and make sure your book club and your congregation reads it and discusses it. He talks about a variety of different things, but he mentions the fact that our society prizes what he calls the veneration of the independent self. We live in a society that we prize our independence. My wife and I were having this interesting discussion at around 8 o'clock this morning. But when you lose independence, when you lose the ability to do things for yourself, you know, and for those of you who've had to deal with this, you know how in our society, how debilitating that can be. If you don't believe me, some of you may have had this experience. You're with your elderly parent where it comes time to have a conversation about when to take the keys to the car away. If you're really bored, have that conversation. You'll know exactly what we're talking about, okay? Because we prize our independence, and when we begin to lose that independence, it changes our psyche. It's a very profound, I think, spiritual concern. What do we do when that begins to happen? These are spiritual moments. And the last thing I want to mention to you is this growing, and the real spiritual issue here, is this growing scientific explosion of trying to crack the age issue. In the last 6 months, there's been a plethora of front page magazine and newspaper articles, everything from Scientific America to Time magazine, talking about that we're going to be able to live to 120, that the scientists right now are cracking the genetic code. The question is, we're going to be able to do that. Science is going to tell us how to do that. But you, as a spiritual leader, then have to ask the question, why? And that's, ladies and gentlemen, where we come into play. Because we're not about the how of existence, we're about the why of existence. All of these statistics, all of these things are not fiction. They are happening right now in our communities, in our congregations. We, all of us in this room, are part of this longevity revolution. I am concerned with the future of congregations dealing with this. All of us have been called to work within and strengthen and ensure a Jewish communal future. How are our congregations, our Jewish communal agencies, responding to these very real challenges? The growing cohort of the post-50-year-olds in our community is not like it was. This is, and you know this from your congregations, this cohort is for the most part an educated, relatively economically secure cohort. They are mivakshim, they are seekers. Seekers of a Jewish world that speaks to the issues that they are dealing with, not in terms of fabricated miracles or little Bubba Mices, but in terms of real seeking from an ancient tradition, a pathway, a guide that can bring meaning and purpose when real life happens, when relationships change or disappear, when our children leave the house, and when our friends begin to die or deal with significant chronic illness, when new challenges and opportunities arise that must be weighed against existing very serious responsibilities. If we do not meet these realities, everyone of this room has lived and have lived some of these, and if you haven't, trust me, you will. If we don't meet these realities within adult Judaism, then we court the danger of ignoring the spiritual capital that resides within what is a quarter of our Jewish community. And make no mistake about it, for all of you have read the Pew studies, the Stephen Cohen studies, the multitude of studies, this is happening. To engage only the youth of our Jewish world is to send a message that courts greater siloization of an already disjointed Jewish world. We are in favor of strengthening our outreach to youth, but to forget about the powerful, creative, and spiritually hungry older adult population is to cut off our institutional and cultural memory, and in doing so, court irrelevancy. I suggest that the baby boomers of the Jewish community are leading in many ways the charge of creating what I call a new American Judaism, a Judaism that is emerging as we speak, and many of you are part of that creativity. These boomers, we expect longevity because our parents' generation pioneered it because of better health care, nutrition, public health, and greater awareness. We are the seekers of meaning that are drifting away from formal affiliation, often shopping in what Wade Clark Roof called the spiritual marketplace. You see this in your own communities. Blending different forms of religious expression into hybrid Judaisms that make sense to them. This is often a more private, personal Judaism, which is reflective of a growing trend in American religion, as every single study has pointed out, a trend that has crept into the ordination of clergy, as this Saturday's New York Times belief column documents. If you haven't read that column, go do what you have to do on the thingies. I'm technologically challenged. I mean, I know how to get scores on this, but when really problem comes, I call a kid. My theory is that every computer box, when you go to the Apple store and get your iMac or whatever, as you open it up, there should be an 8-year-old in there. No, seriously. Well, you're sitting in an airport, okay? This is an aside. I'll finish on time, don't worry. I have till 10:15, who cares? Oh, cool it. You're sitting in an airport and you're trying to figure out how to download a file from your motherboard or your cloud. I still don't know what a cloud is. And across from you is sitting a 1-year-old in diapers. Mommy gives him her iPhone and the kid knows what to do. 1-year-old. How many of you seen that? If I'm lying, I'm dying. Yeah, it's amazing. And they can't speak English, so you can't ask them. No, seriously, I tried this. First of all, I almost got arrested because I walked up to the little kid and said, can you help me figure this out? And the kid looked at me and said, Gaga, get out of here. Which I think translated meant, man, are you old and stupid? This is true. Anyway, so this morning, very briefly, I want to lay out with you some ideas on a path to sacred aging, an approach that I hope you consider, and to take some programmatic ideas back home with you that spring from some of these conversations here and some of the conversations we'll have in the workshop. These are based upon my experience these last several years with the Sacred Aging Project that I direct for cantors. As your profile increases within congregations, within chaplaincies, and with Jewish agencies, you guys are uniquely positioned to bring your training and talents, and most of all, your passion to this challenge. This approach is based upon 6 classic texts taken from Torah, that I think can provide a foundation for our own aging and for a creative approach to aging within our own people, a springboard for some programmatic ideas. As I said, we'll discuss some of these in the workshops. I call this because I needed a title, The Theology of Relationships, but it's based upon a very, very simple, because I'm from Philly, we got to keep it simple, a very simple idea that has become more important to me, especially as I've gotten older. And this is a belief that as we get older, we are called upon by our tradition to never stop growing, to never stop learning. That mythology that age is only a number is true. You see this in people. You have people in your congregation who are 85 who get up every day and are alive and looking and searching. And you have people in your congregation who are 45 and who are spiritually and emotionally dead. It's also based on a very simple idea. That as we get a little older, and I want you to think of your own life, one of, if not the most important things that we have are not the status, are not the work, but are the relationships that we have with other human beings. And when those relationships end, that hole, that emptiness, at times is extremely difficult to fill. And as we get a little older, the power and importance of those relationships becomes so very, very much more paramount. Many of us in this room have done funerals. I would challenge us to figure out, when we've done those eulogies or have kids or grandchildren do those eulogies, rarely do they discuss the deceased's economic prowess. You know what they talk about? The smile, the hug, that sense of that trip that we took. The power of relationships becomes even more powerful and important and present as we ourselves become more aware of the sands of our own time. We begin to see this from these series of texts, from the very, very first text in our tradition, from the fact of Tzelem Elohim, from the beginning of Genesis, our own creation, a creation of intentionality. We are created for a purpose. As Alan Middleman discusses in his very, very interesting new book, Human Nature and the Jewish Thought, the Midrash that he cites on our own creation provide the basis for our understanding of Judaism's approach that there's a reason that each one of us are here. Those opening passages of Genesis are so powerful in our approach to sacred aging and the importance of being in relationship. Look at one of my favorite texts, Genesis 2:18. We are told that it is not good for us to be alone. Right, we all know that the context is the creation of Eve. But as all of us know, the Torah is metaphor at a very, very high level. This text underscores the need for people to be with others. The text refers to that sense of existential aloneness that so often impact people as they age, as they see their world contract, as they lose spouses, friends, sometimes even children, as they begin to lose independence and at times even begin to lose their sense of self. Study after study, as late as this weekend's Wall Street Journal articles, reminds us that isolation is literally, literally a killer. That people who continue social engagement are healthier, live longer, and yes, even die better. By the way, there's been studies by Duke and a couple of other places that joining a synagogue lengthens life. Take that back to your membership committee. Live longer, join a shul. Guilt works. As we mentioned before, the mental health aspects of isolation are growing, and likewise, many of you have counseled people who are entering the literal last stages of life. And many of these comments indicate several key fears: a fear of pain and suffering, and a fear of dying alone. It is not good that we are alone. For as we age, we come to understand that at the heart of our fear of aloneness is the fear of the ultimate aloneness, and that is our own death. Which leads to the second text, Genesis 3, the profoundly brilliant passage in which the biblical author introduces us to the reality of our own mortality. Here is the basis, I believe, of the foundation and the beginning of every single religion: the fear of death and the desire on our part not to die. So it is no coincidence that it is in this chapter that we meet God's first and most important question, Ayekah, where are you? This is a question that grows in importance as we age. Where are we? Where are you? Where am I? This is the question we seek to answer for our entire lives. This is the question that boomers are now fixating on. For as we transition into life stages, people in our 60s and our early 70s, they can, God willing, we expect decades more of life. What to do with this time? So we come to the questions of intentionality and that are raised in creation. What I would suggest to you are the questions of what I call the why questions of existence, the only questions that really matter. And I'm going to suggest to you in the heart of hearts, in those dark recesses at night when we shut the lights out and the deflector shields come down, to quote another Torah, that these three questions are the only questions that matter that arise from Genesis 3. Why was I born? Why must I die? Why am I here? Does my life have meaning? Does my life have purpose? In answering these questions, I believe that each of us ask these questions and do so with greater frequency as we get older. We are confronting the choices of holding on and letting go. So the text of Genesis 12 is so powerful. Lech Lecha commands Abraham to go forth to a land that he does not know. He's told to go forth in faith. Its meaning, I suggest, the text is telling us that no matter what age we are, do not fear to move forward, to accept that new challenge, to keep evolving as a human being. Yet we often cannot. By the time we get to be adults, our desire to move forward is often constrained by circumstances of life. And that frustration is also often turned inward. Yet the text again is instructive, for Abraham can only go forth after what takes place at the end of Genesis chapter 11, for it is there in that chapter, in the very end, that Abraham's father dies. It's as if we are told that often we are given the freedom or permission to lech lecha after a major life event, a death, a divorce, a new job offer, a grandchild, a transition from full-time work, and other events that change the stasis of our existence and often open a door to a possible future, a future that may involve, as we see in Genesis 32, a change in our own identity. For Jacob's wrestling with a Malach results in him being known by a different name. So too do we, as we get older, wrestle with dreams and desires, aware that those sands of time are flowing faster, and that try as we might, we do not control time. We merely, as one author recently wrote, rent it. What Judaism is telling us, I believe, is that we have the permission from our tradition to change what we do, who and what we are, and what we call ourselves. And this is an empowering concept to come from a faith community that encourages a sense of movement, a sense of freedom and growth. It is an idea that we can never stand still, that we are constantly changing. And when we stop evolving, when we stop our own sense of lech lecha, we stagnate and we die, if not literally, then spiritually. And this sense of change and growth is also evident in our relationship with God, for Exodus chapter 3 teaches us that. You remember that Moses is but the bush, and the bush is burning, and he says, and the bush says, go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. And Moses, being a natural cynic from Jersey, he says, listen, Mr. Bush, give me a name. I need a name. I can't go to Pharaoh and say there's a flaming bush that's telling me to let my people go. Sechel, you know? So what is the name? Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. This brilliant passage in Hebrew, which in most of the modern commentaries is not translated. In that phrase, I see that we are also given the permission to change how we see God, how we relate to that concept. For the God of our youth is not the God of our 30s or 40s or 60s or 70s. and certainly not of our 80s and 90s. Again, this wonderful instruction from the text and from tradition, do not be hesitant to encounter your relationship with God in different ways. This evolution of individual relationships and definitions of what God is in our lives become manifest in how we translate these changes into practical life. Thus, Leviticus 19 becomes so important. For what we are seeing is this growing desire on the part of people as they get older to give something back to our community. This whole encore career explosion by Mark Friedman's all over the country. You may be seeing it in your own communities. To give back to the community, to the practical application of the phrase, Kedoshim Tehiyu, you shall be holy. This idea of making your life holy. That is why so many congregations, from some perhaps some of your congregations, have become legacy or life review programs which seek to harness the spiritual capital and life experience of their elders. We saw this pioneered with the Holocaust generation and the memory programs. Think of what you can do in your congregation by assembling sort of like a Sanhedrin, a sort of collection of vatikim or elders, pairing them with teens and young adults. Think of the possibilities for mentoring, of intergenerational dialogue, which in most congregations do not happen. Think of the power you could unleash by gathering a group of 60-year-olds or 70-year-olds and have them reflect on the events just of the past 2 weeks, the lessons learned from those good old days of the 60s and 70s, which, by the way, the music was better. And the proof of that is our kids are listening to it. On vinyl is back. By the way, I'm convinced in about 20 years, I used to talk about this with my best buddy, Jakey, Olav Shalom, and we were convinced that we were sitting in the rocking chair at Shady Acres on the patio about 20 years from now on the bulletin board. You know, there would be appearing in the community room at 2 o'clock the Rolling Stones. It's only a matter of time till they do the assisted living circuit. I mean, dipped in formaldehyde and every, you know, like, there we go. Can you imagine, this is a whole, this is, I'm running out of time. But can you imagine the Stones doing, I Can't Get No Satisfaction at Shady Acres? Hey, this is our future, babes, come on. But think about what you do and put this group of people together who lived through Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the birth of rock and roll, really the new rock and roll, Watergate. The lessons that if you looked at the newspaper in the last 2 weeks, we still haven't learned. Think about going home and bringing this group of people together and starting this type of dialogue. I think you could do some amazing things within our congregations and also teach some very valuable lessons. This sense of the sacred carries over into your office dialogue, I'm sure many of you have had, with two of the most pressing events that confront our families, caregiving and decision-making at the end of life. We'll talk about these in the workshops. Both we will deal with, but many of us know these questions that are asked. How do I make a decision, a Jewishly informed decision that is sacred? And that leads to the very last text, this magnificent text of Deuteronomy 29 and 30, Parashat Nitzavim, which reminds us that in life we shall be confronted with many choices, choices between good and evil, blessing and curse. And so we're asked in the text to uvacharta chaim, make choices that sanctify life so that, as the B part of the verse says that we rarely teach people, that those who follow us may live. So what we choose does make a difference. What we choose does impact our future. What we choose does impact our legacy. What we leave to our children and our grandchildren. How do we teach these boomers that Judaism understands that the choices we make now determine the type of people that we become, that the choices we make help determine our family's future? And what of that future? How do we wish to send us into that future? Perhaps that is why so many congregations are now re-emphasizing programs developing ethical wills, something that we need to really focus on. For those of us who are grandparents, you know the power of Deuteronomy 30. For those of us who are grandparents, and we look into the eyes of our grandchildren, those precious little kids, and we know that no matter how hard we pray, we cannot go where they are going to go. And so the spiritual question is, what can I leave of my life that they can take with them into that unknown Lech Lecha future? Deuteronomy 30 is a key passage for us as we age, but the choices that we often must make are life-altering. How are we teaching our people to make Jewish life choices? Choices for life, even as life may begin to ebb. How are we teaching Jewish approaches to dealing with the randomness of life events? That phone call that brings a diagnosis that we did not expect. The random accident that we did not plan for. That job offer that surprises us but means that we must uproot and change all that we know. That meeting with an individual that changes our life when we had given up hope that we would ever find a soulmate. How do we do that and continue to respond to God's Ayeka? The revolution in longevity is presenting our community with unprecedented opportunities for creative thought and ritual, practice, and communal revisioning. Through it all is the realization that our time is becoming more precious, that priorities may need to be reevaluated, and that relationships, friends, and family provide the embrace of community that holds us and so often supports us. How we as a community respond to this revolution in meaning and seeking may well form the basis of the type of community that we hand to our children and grandchildren. Our very sacred texts teach us that growth and change are a positive value in life, that to stay the same is to stagnate and spiritually die. These texts teach us that we are given the permission to evolve as human beings in our relationships with others, with ourself, and with our God as we seek to answer that fundamental question of Ayeka. Look, many of us are sitting in seminars and stuff and hear people talk about the statistics and they are doom and gloomers. I am not one of them. I will tell you point blank that I believe that this is one of those exciting times to be involved in Judaism and in synagogue life, despite what all these other people are saying. It's exciting because it's changing. The Judaism that I grew up with in at Reform Congregation Knesset Israel in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, in the 1960s is gone. It's over. We are all creating something brand new. That's the excitement. Do not give in to these doom and gloomers. Understand that Judaism has survived because we've always have had the ability to adapt to a new society and innovate new Judaisms. That's what we're doing right now. It may look different, but we've always looked different. We just have to have the courage to that Lech Lecha thing. We are wrestling now with this new innovative thrust, and we may be called different names and a different type of Judaism, but that's how we have survived. You, the cantors of our movement, stand at the forefront, really, of the possibilities to help steer the creation of this new American Judaism into a possible future that values every Tzelem Elohim for Lidor Vador. I invite you to seize these moments to Lech Lecha, to return to your home, and see in this longevity generation the untapped possibility of harnessing a wealth of life experience, a wealth of creativity, and a wealth of holiness. That is our choice. Boker Tov.
We hope you enjoyed this program. For more information, visit JewishSacredAging.com.